Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook.
It's Tuesday, May 7th. From HBR2, it's The Conversation. A visit from Jerry the Green Giant.
In IAEA, we hide and go spring.
How do you get to be a really good nurse? Practitioner, practitioner, practitioner.
It ain't jungle rocket science, but it rocks.
Plus, Al Jazeera with the Global Report, fast eats in the backyard, and no fast kumbaya over a monument's fate in the reality check. Now the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Obama has just concluded a summit with South Korea's new president, Park Geun-hye, with whom he expressed solidarity against a nuclear threat posed by North Korea.
The United States and the Republic of Korea are as united as ever, and faced with new international sanctions, North Korea is more isolated than ever. The days when North Korea could create a crisis and elicit concessions, those days are over.
Meanwhile, U.S. officials are saying North Korea may be dialing down its latest threat in the region. They say the military has removed medium-range ballistic missiles from a launch site that was prepared for a possible test firing. The Pentagon is estimating that the number of military personnel who have been sexually assaulted has increased by more than a third since 2010. The new report says as many as 26,000 service members were assaulted last year. NPR's Craig Windham says the study was released a day after the Air Force announced that its chief sexual assault prevention officer was under arrest for allegedly groping a woman.
Police in Arlington, Virginia say Lieutenant Colonel Jeffrey Krasinski was under the influence of alcohol when he allegedly grabbed the woman in a parking lot. Air Force Chief of Staff General Mark Welsh tells the Senate Armed Services Committee that he's appalled by the allegations, which he called deeply troubling.
Sexual assault prevention and response efforts are critically important to us. It is unacceptable that this occurs anywhere at any time in our Air Force. And we will not quit working this problem.
Committee Chairman Senator Carl Levin says the arrest speaks volumes about the status and effectiveness of the Defense Department's efforts to address the plague of sexual assaults in the military. Craig Windham, NPR News, Washington.
In Cleveland, three brothers are in police custody in connection with three women who had been missing for roughly a decade. Brian Bull of member station WCPN reports charges are expected soon.
Ariel Castro owned the house where the three women and a six-year-old girl had apparently been held in captivity. After one of them, Amanda Berry, escaped with the help of a neighbor last night, Castro and his two brothers, Pedro and O'Neill, were taken in. Michelle Knight, Gina DeJesus, and the girl, believed to be Berry's, were discovered by investigators, alive and in good health. Cleveland Chief Deputy Ed Tombas says for years, police followed up on all tips, digging up backyards and attending vigils. He praised Berry for the break in the case.
The real hero here is Amanda. I mean, she's the one that got this rolling. We're following her lead. Without her, none of us would be here today.
For NPR News, I'm Brian Bull in Cleveland.
At last check on Wall Street, Dow was up 73 points at 15,042. NASDAQ gaining 4 at 33.97. S&P 500 up 8 at 16.25. This is NPR News. French authorities have arrested six suspected members of Basque separatist group ETA. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports that they were detained in simultaneous police operations at three sites across France.
The French Interior Ministry says the six under arrest are possibly key players in various strategic cells of the Basque separatist movement. ETA has been blamed for more than 800 deaths in the last decade. Unusually, the suspects were detained at three sites lying beyond traditional Basque country in southwest France and northern Spain. Though waves of arrests by French and Spanish authorities working together have weakened ETA in recent years, France continues to serve as a military operations base for the more militant Spanish Basque separatists. Basques have a separate language and identity. Only a tiny minority want an independent homeland. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Unarmed military observers have been kidnapped by a Syrian rebel group for the second time in 2 months. The United Nations says four Filipinos were detained in a region that separates Syria and Israel. The UN says the Yarmouk Martyrs Brigades is claiming responsibility. That's the same group that abducted 21 Filipino peacekeepers in early March, and they were released days later. Football fans are learning today who will be part of the new class of 12 former players or coaches in the College Football Hall of Fame. Among those to be inducted in December, Heisman Trophy winners Danny Werfel of Florida, Ron Dain of Wisconsin, and Vinny Testaverde of Miami. The National Football Foundation also selected coaches Bill McCartney of Colorado and Wayne Harden, who led Navy and Temple. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from The Pajamagram Company, offering women's pajamas in gift packaging delivered overnight and for Mother's Day at pajamagram.com.
This is The Conversation on HPR 2. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Maybe you've had it with all the green jokes, green washing, and call-outs to be sustainable in a color palette befitting Oz. But there are some realities in those euphemisms for good and not-so-good marketing with the planet and your checking account in mind. Jerry Udelson hopes you're far from done with greening your life. He's in Hawaii to keynote at the Build and Buy Green Conference and Expo, and he joins us this morning. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
We talk a lot about being green. A lot of people talk about being green. But you look at us from a different perspective coming here from the mainland, where being green, building green, retrofitting green is your business. What do you see when you look at Hawaii?
What I see is a place that could be much greener than it is, a place that could run itself on 100% natural energies from wind and sun and tides and waves, but isn't doing it. And I always wonder why.
That question has been around for a while. I mean, as in decades and decades. But for right now, where we are, just where we are now, what would you think is our basic issue that we have to take on now, lest we still be talking about it to our peril 10 years from now?
Well, I think the basic issue is that global climate change is going to drive the conversation much faster than it would ordinarily. And Hawaii really has to think of itself, as I'm sure it does in many respects, as an island nation and as one that's going to have to become more and more self-sufficient over time.
We know in sort of the back recesses of our mind that we're out here pretty much on our own and farthest away from any other place on Earth, and we've tried to make stabs at being more self-sufficient. There have been a lot of kerfuffles over that. But when it comes to people in their own homes or businesses trying to retrofit what buildings there are in this relatively small little place, what advice would you have for them right now, today?
Well, if you own a commercial office building, for example, you can secure significant competitive advantage by getting it green certified under the U.S. Green Building Council's LEED certification. We've seen this happen in every big city in the U.S. and many small cities. So I would say take another look at your options for making sure that you're successful in the marketplace over the next 5, 10, 15 years.
To get the certification for the Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, which some businesses have, certainly at some of the buildings in the university, others are building to LEED specifications, that's a whole undertaking. Sometimes that's a little scary. Should it be?
Well, you need to have people that know what they're doing, but the bottom line is LEED is a collection of best practices. And so if you commit your business to sustainability objectives and to sustainable best practices, you should be able to do these certifications with almost no additional cost and with a significant marketplace benefit.
And we do have, as you mentioned, the experts necessary to help that process happen.
I'm sure you do. They're all over the U.S. In fact, there's roughly 200,000 accredited professionals in the LEED system, which just by way of contrast is double the number of members of the American Institute of Architects. So if you will, we've basically trained all the architects and engineers in the country over the last 12 years in how to do this. It's more a matter of intent. If you want to intend to have your business be successful over the long run, you have to think of branding it by some recognized third-party green scheme.
You're an engineer by trade. Is that why you refocus your attention on building green?
Well, I've been in this about 15 years, and what really interested me as an environmentalist, really, by history and an engineer by training, is that this is an opportunity both to do things right for the planet and do things right for the pocketbook.
That's been the argument for, obviously, decades and decades, too. It's also, though, difficult when you have homeowners who are feeling incredibly stressed and they think, what, now we need to do this, too. And despite, you know, the solar tax credits and other boons that have come along if they buy energy-efficient appliances and other things where people think, well, I'm kind of doing my part in this way, your point has been there's so much more that we should be doing and could be if we just set our minds to it. Why has there been such a barrier, do you think, for Hawaii in taking this on in big and small ways?
I think for the same reason that there are issues with Hawaii's isolation is that maybe people haven't caught up with this way of thinking as much. When you live in a very mild climate, it's hard to think about, oh, I don't need to worry about heating and so forth. If you look at commercial buildings, however, you realize that half of the energy use, even in an efficient commercial building, comes from lights and what we call plug loads or computers, anything you plug into a wall, printers, copiers. And those are the things that are driving energy use into the future to stay high. Those are things that are well within the control of most users, that you can easily cut lighting energy use and computer energy use by half without almost any expenditure. In fact, you'll probably come out money ahead over the long run.
And that doesn't include AC use.
It doesn't include AC use, but most buildings are over-ventilated because they try to do all the ventilation with the AC. So what we're seeing in a lot of mainland buildings now is separating the ventilation of a building, which is fresh air, from the cooling of a building using radiant systems, which have become very popular all over the West Coast and in other parts of the country. So there's a lot of technical options that a good engineer should know how to do and a good architect should know how to do. It's really a matter, though, of the building owners initiating that conversation.
And for people who are in condos and who own them and want to see that become a little greener and are trying to do retrofits, they've probably done all the simple stuff now, but what would be the one next thing that you would ask them to look at doing in the very near future?
Well, if you're talking about high-rise condos, you obviously have to focus on the efficiency of the common equipment. But any building that's small, that's one or two stories, could be 100% solar powered over the course of a year on a net energy basis and come out money ahead over the long run. And there's a lot of financing groups, such as Solar City is one I know about, that will do it all for you. And you just agree to essentially buy their electricity from them into the future.
So if you had to grade Hawaii, given all of the states where you've been and spoken, and obviously your homestead of Arizona, but how would you grade Hawaii now in its attempt to be far more energy efficient and to build green?
Well, I don't want to be the outsider coming in and,
but you are,
and giving Hawaii a grade, but I would say probably in the middle of the pack. I've seen some very interesting zero net energy projects here. I've seen a living building certification here. So I'm seeing things that are happening, but not in any sort of coherent, comprehensive way that would strike most people's attention.
Some would say that's a little bit like our urban planning.
I don't know about your urban planning. All I know is there's a lot of traffic in Waikiki.
All right. Well, Jerry, thank you for coming in, and good luck with the conference this Friday. Jerry Udelson is often called the godfather of green. He was one of the world's first green building consultants, leadership in energy and environmental design trainers, that would be LEED trainers, and writers about sustainable development. He advocates for the transformations of buildings and cities into more sustainable urban places with fewer adverse impacts on the natural world, which is why he's in Honolulu this week to speak at the Build and Buy Green Conference on Friday.
This is the conversation on statewide member-supported HPR 2. Later in the show, putting a spring in young steps and what to do with what was once a real dive.
During the 1950s, the drive-in phenomenon swept the nation, and Hawaii was no exception. Eating habits were changing fast, literally, as fast food was sometimes served by car hops on roller skates. Historically, it was also the first time teens had access to both pocket money and their own transportation. Drive-ins were the perfect places to rendezvous and to consume calorific standard teen fare, hamburgers, fries, and maybe even a cherry Coke. On Oahu, Scotty's Drive-In opened on Keeaumoku Street in 1956, and this inspired a couple of young men to introduce the concept to Sandy Little Kailua a year later. For today's quiz, can you name this Windward eatery of a bygone era and its owners? Order up a chocolate malt and listen to the radio. The answer's coming up in the next half hour.
Take out the papers and the trash.
Hi. Good morning. I'm Shauna Tonkin from the Pacific Aviation Museum, Pearl Harbor. You're listening to member-supported HPR2, live on the web at hawaiipublicradio.org.
The value of school arts programs has been proven again and again as the lessons learned are felt in areas of life where they're least expected. The arts teach self-confidence and cooperation, and dance students get an extra benefit. You have to be in great shape to be a good dancer, and dancers tend to see their physical health as something that's essential to their art. Elizabeth Savage is a junior at Aiea High School. She's preparing her role in the school's spring dance concert, and she's with us this morning. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning.
What did you get out of studying dance aside from learning to dance?
Trust. I've learned to trust people and also my own body, and with that, I feel like I have more confidence in myself, like more confidence. So I'm able to do things that I've never really thought that I could do. And once I put my mind to it, dance has really helped me prove to myself that I can do it and also trust other people and also trust myself.
That's a pretty huge set of lessons, isn't
yes.
it? I mean, those have a lot of effect way beyond learning to dance.
Yes.
Did you expect to get that much out of it?
No. I used to think dance was just moving my body and performing, but that was before I joined Aiea Repertory Dance Company.
Mm-hmm.
And once I joined the program, I learned that it's a lot more than just dancing. I have to be able to have trust in the people that's going to be catching me when I'm doing this crazy jump.
Quite literally.
Yes.
Flying
and
through
the air.
And
know that they're there.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's a pretty good trust exercise, isn't it?
Yes.
Was that sort of daunting the first time you tried it?
It was. But then as I remember doing this one move, and I was just spinning in the air with my partner, and I loved it. It was just, it was like a rush in my body. Mm-hmm. And then every time I would do these lifts with my partner, I would just keep on going at it. And it's called flying. Mm-hmm. And I remember I would always be flying with my partner. So once I got that out of the way, being scared, I just couldn't stop lifting.
You know, Elizabeth, a lot of people in the performing arts describe that moment when they're performing as maybe the most free they can feel.
Yes.
Is that true for you?
It is, because when you're dancing, you're basically expressing everything through your movements. You don't have to be speaking, and you're showing people your story with the movements that you make in your body. And it's much better than saying the words out, because it's like you're telling a story to the people, and you feel free when you're doing that. Mm-hmm. You're not holding anything back.
Part of your whole education in dance has been sort of not just adapting to new ways of moving, but to responding to types of music that you hadn't been exposed to before, right?
Yeah, I grew up basically just listening to hip-hop and thinking that was art. But turns out I was very wrong once I joined the company, because now I'm listening to opera, classical music, and it's opened my eyes and my ears, saying that that is art, and that's what's artistic. It's not hip-hop and just that crazy music that plays on the radio. It's ballet and modern music.
Well, I mean, presumably art can be whatever it wants to be, right? Mm-hmm. But it's certainly a lot bigger picture than you thought.
Yes, know? Yes.
Are there still areas of music for you to explore that you haven't looked into yet? You know, have you checked out African music and things from different parts of the world?
Not much, but then we have done some African music, mm-hmm. but we haven't really been focusing on that. So mm-hmm. now all I'm what I'm doing is ballet and modern. That's my focus right now, because that's what I need in the future, especially in college, because those are the two like basics that I need to learn.
So you want to take the path of getting some very serious training, is what
yes.
it sounds like.
Yes.
With what eventual goal in mind? Do you know yet? I mean, you're a high school junior. It would be perfectly acceptable to say, no, you don't know yet.
I just want to be a dancer when I grow up. I want to be in that field. And I've also been blessed to go train at Duke University for mm-hmm. the American Dance Festival. So I will be improving a lot this summer for 6 weeks, and my body will just be taking in everything that I can, and I will need that for the future.
It's interesting that you say your body will be taking in everything I can, because most people would say my mind will be taking in everything I can. But a dancer has a different approach in the sense that maybe mind and body aren't that separate for you.
You need both.
You yes. sure do, yeah.
But I can't go through a day without dancing, because my body needs it. And just going through the weekend without dancing, I already feel weak. So I need to be dancing every single day.
Well, that's the kind of, I mean, as you've probably already figured out, that's the kind of dedication you're going to need, right? I mean, if you hated dance class and you hated to practice, you'd have a pretty rough road ahead, wouldn't you?
Yes.
So is it about, was it tough learning to love the, I mean, there's drudgery involved, right? I mean, just a lot of repetitive movement, aches and pains.
Yes.
Are you okay with all that?
Oh, absolutely. Even though it's difficult and my body will get sore, it still doesn't change my love for it, because I know that that's what I need to do in order to become a dancer. It's not going to be easy, and I knew that from the moment that I joined the company. So all of this, is like, I know that that's what's involved.
Was that a hard attitude to adopt? I mean, I would think it would be. You're still young, yeah?
Yes, because I wasn't really disciplined when I joined the company. And joining it, it opened me to be very disciplined in my mind and just with what people tell me to do, because I can't just go off of my own plans now. I have to be committed to everything that I do, especially in the dance program.
So you have to, in a way, learn to sort of love the idea of being a very disciplined artist.
Yes.
That was a big change from where you were before.
Yes, because I did not do anything, really, once I was in high school. I wasn't in any clubs, so dance helped me a lot in that, and I needed that.
Kind of getting a sense of purpose, a sense of mission for your future, huh?
Yes.
Terrific, Elizabeth. Really good talking to you.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Savage is a junior at IAEA High School and a member of the IAEA Dance Repertory Company. The 7th Annual Spring Dance Concert runs the next 2 weekends, and details are on our HPR website.
Support for today's programming comes from Four Seasons Resort Maui's Vintage Wine Weekend. 3 days of wine-inspired events with wine experts and master sommeliers, May 24th through 26th. Maui.fourseasons.com.
On Talk of the Nation, we talk about what you're talking about.
I turned on the radio and I heard this and I nearly drove off the freeway.
I have experienced a lot of what you've been talking about.
I'm Neil Cownan. Surprising voices, interesting conversations on the topics you're talking about. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Weekday mornings from 9 to 11, right after the conversation.
HPR listeners who are also members recognize the vital connection between their support and the station's health. Mahalo to Joe Matthews of Kihei, Judy Shishido of Honolulu, and Hart Miller of Pahoa for their membership gifts. Many members prefer the convenience of giving monthly through the station's lifetime membership program. Choose the amount you want to give, adjust it at any time in the future, and you'll be secure in knowing that you've done your part. Information and a downloadable gift form are at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. It's 8:27. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR 2. Community groups have fought over the Waikiki War Memorial for decades, and just as long the fate of the natatorium has been at an effective standstill. Last week, Governor Abercrombie and Honolulu Mayor Caldwell joined hands in a show of unity with a new idea to put the fight to rest, but there seems to be no end in sight to the battle over the historic monument. CivilBeat.com reporter Chad Blair joins us for today's reality check. Hi, Chad.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
I mean, a case of really it's not over until it's over, and it's not going to be over anytime soon, which is effectively where we've been for a very, very long time. What happened that it looked like it was sort of maybe okay last week? Even a member of the Kapi'olani Park Preservation Society was there and looked to be on board with this, but now we find out not so.
Right. I mean, in a nutshell, this is a battle between, really a war over the war memorial, if I can say that, between one group that would like to preserve the structure. It's historic. It honors World War I veterans. The other side wants it torn down and wants beach restored to the area. The plan introduced by the governor and the mayor calls for tearing down the pool, tearing down the bleachers, moving the memorial arch back a ways from the beach, and then putting sand in there. But you mentioned the Kapi'olani Park Preservation Society. Not all members support the idea. They were not on board last week when the plan was announced. Friends of the Nautitorium, that's another group, wants to restore it. They're thinking about suing. And Councilman Stanley Chang, whose area district includes Waikiki, wants to survey his residents. In a nutshell, these folks feel like they weren't part of the conversation, if you will, about what to do with the war memorial.
Which is kind of what we've been hearing time and time again, that somehow this was not an inclusive plan, or that there was no way of being able to have any sort of compromise between these two factions. It doesn't look any better today.
No, it doesn't. And it has been literally 3 or 4 decades that this has been going on. It's really an eyesore there in Waikiki, this saltwater pool that has not been used in a long time. It's basically, well, I won't tell you what's in there, but it's pretty ugly.
It's too early for me to even consider that right now.
Exactly. Now, should the community have some input on this, particularly folks that live in the area? Chang thinks so. So far, he said it's been mixed results in terms of the feedback he's been getting, some favoring restoration, some favoring tearing it down.
But a big part of this is going to be the money, because with every day, decade that goes by, it becomes a worse situation. It's going to take more and more money and more today dollars to either restore it or to tear it down.
That's right. The current estimates to restore $70 million versus $18 million to tear it down. That may be the ultimate decider in what to do. Then you have to get money from the council and the legislature, so there's another battle there.
Bottom line is, it isn't over till it's over, and it's not going to be over for a very long time, as we started with this conversation saying, so effectively, we're still at the same place.
Yes, we are.
Thanks, Chad. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Sure. Sounds good, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair is a political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR 2. I'm Chris Vandercook. Coming up, nursing a better understanding of nurses and keep your jungle boogie. We got a rocket. Now for today's international news, here's Al Jazeera.
This is Al Jazeera. I'm Dedi Nabugeda with a check on your world headlines. Libya's defense minister has quit over what he's calling an assault on democracy. Mohamed El-Barghathi resigned because of a siege by armed groups on the justice and foreign affairs ministries last week. Parliament buckled on Sunday to their main demand, and they were calling for former Gaddafi officials to be banned from holding senior government positions. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Moscow to meet Russia's President Vladimir Putin. The United States and Russia back opposite sides in Syria's civil war. Kerry wants Putin to put more pressure on President Bashar al-Assad, but Russia has so far opposed the West's calls for him to step down. Violence continues to plague the run-up to Pakistan's general election on Saturday. At least 6 people have been killed and 20 others injured in the area of the Lower Deer District. And the target of the explosion was a campaign rally for the Pakistan People's Party. Kamal Haidar has more.
The brother of the provincial candidate from the Pakistan People's Party succumbed to his wounds. We are told he was killed in that particular attack in which 6 people are now reported to have been killed. A number of people wounded. Earlier in the day, another deadly attack took place in a very busy market area of Doaba, which is not very far from the city of Kohat. In that, a corner meeting was targeted by a motorcycle bomb.
Israel's finance minister says he will block any attempt to sell one of the country's most famous resources. Minerals from the Dead Sea feed a huge factory producing potash, a vital ingredient for fertilizers. It's owned by Israeli tycoons, but a Canadian company wants to buy it.
Some say the Dead Sea is Israel's only real natural resource. Its minerals feed this huge factory producing potash, the vital ingredient for fertilizers. For years, the Dead Sea Works was owned by the State of Israel, now by a private company. In a bid supported by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a Canadian company wants to buy it, but Israel's new finance minister, Yair Lapid, says no and wants it to stay in Israeli hands.
I think Netanyahu has always supported foreign investment, especially in corporate foreign investment, and Israel thinks it's important. But in this case, Lapid felt it was against the interests of ordinary Israelis, so he felt he had to take a stance against it.
The current owners are Israeli tycoons, the Offer family. The Dead Sea operation is worth $17 billion. That's where this Israeli story gets more complicated. There are economic hard times ahead, according to many, and people here increasingly resent the power of Israel's super rich, the Offers included. Opposing their deal and their ownership of a valuable natural resource like this one is good politics. The state has a stake, but there are arguments about royalties and tax. Some say foreign ownership threatens revenue and jobs. Others that foreign investment is essential. There's also a sense that for too long, a small wealthy elite have had too much wealth and influence. Dissatisfaction over the cost of living in Israel led to the success of Lapid's new party, and he's out to make Israel's economy fairer. The future of the Dead Sea Works may be the first of many battles in a long and painful struggle to rebalance Israel's economy. Simon McGregor Wood, Al Jazeera, at the Dead Sea Works.
You can find the latest on all those stories and much more at aljazeera.com.
Often around here, one conversation spins another, which is really good considering the name of this show. Last week on Town Square, we considered the physicians' shortage, the changing role of doctors, and additional opportunities for nurse practitioners. Two issues emerged. Most people didn't really have an idea of what nurse practitioners do, and for some folks who have seen one, they felt a little cheated at not seeing a doctor. Neither revelation was particularly startling to nurse practitioners, and as it is Nurses Week, we asked Hawaii State Center for Nursing Executive Director Deborah Gardner for a little clarification. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me here today.
Now, you have the experience of having been on the mainland at the National Institute for Health and other places where you've seen how nurses are regarded differently, perhaps, than we regard them here. Would you say that maybe our perspective is more of the a nurse is a nurse is a nurse variety?
Yes, that's well said. Yes, a nurse is a nurse, but a nurse practitioner is not a nurse. It's a registered nurse who has at least a master's degree and often a doctorate degree. And nurse practitioners are a part of what we call the APRNs, or Advanced Practice Registered Nurses. There are clinical nurse specialists, there's nurse anesthetists, and nurse practitioners, as you mentioned, and clinical nurse specialists. So these nurses have been around for really almost 40 years, and they are able to do 60 to 80% of primary care like a physician does. They're not substitutes, they're additions, because they bring to the table not only the ability to do physicals and write prescriptions, you know, as they diagnose and refer people to other practitioners and specialists, but they also have with them in the basis of nursing the idea of community care and prevention and public health. And as Obamacare is implemented, the need for us to have a bigger view of health care and the spectrum of care is going to be very critical. And I think an APRN, or a nurse practitioner, as is commonly noted, really bring that to the table.
If APRNs have been around for 40 years, and we really don't have a great deal of understanding of what they do with them here, what happened that we sort of didn't get on that bandwagon to readjust healthcare as it was clearly adjusting itself on the mainland?
Well, that's a really good question.
Because this is not Obamacare. This is just, you know, kind of way life was evolving.
Well, part of the evolution was education, and people have been educated in silos. So physicians didn't always know what a nurse practitioner could provide. Nurse practitioners didn't always know what physicians did as much as they do now. We have moved into what we call interprofessional education, in which nurses and doctors, pharmacists are learning together as students, and they're understanding much better and respecting each other at a greater level as they learn what each other know. So that has occurred. The other thing I think is that in a state like this where there's so much rural care and you have so many independent practitioners, often what other people bring to the team and to the patient is forgotten.
And that whole team-centered approach, which is now, you know, patient-centered care and the team, the home approach, that's been something we've been hearing about and moving toward, at least in theory. In practice, it's taken a little longer. But because you just mentioned that we've had so many independent practitioners, so many docs who are on their own, that we really don't even have fluency with real group practices here.
That's absolutely right. And if you don't work with those people, you don't understand what they can offer. It was wonderful 2 weeks ago when there was the Physician Workforce Conference here in Hawaii. A physician stood up and said, I have a nurse practitioner in my practice, because we were trying to explain the role to physicians. Much less also, as you said, the public doesn't understand. He goes, oh, I have a nurse practitioner because she reminds me, she brings extra dimension and depth to my practice around what are we doing around prevention, what are we doing with basic health for the patient. So I really value her. And I think for the public, you mentioned earlier about feeling cheated. As a practitioner myself, or in the early days, I can remember saying, well, let's talk a little while. I was a psych CNS, and I would say, let's talk a little while, and then, of course, if you prefer to see the physician, the psychiatrist, that'll be fine. By the time the conversation was over, they were very happy to stay and continue to work with me, and I've heard that from many of my peers that are in primary care or work with geriatrics.
Sometimes it's just a matter of being able to have that initial conversation.
Yes.
To make someone feel comfortable, but also the time to have that conversation is usually better placed with a nurse practitioner. It seems, at least in the experience of some of our callers last week, that they got more time when they were with a nurse practitioner.
Currently, that's the case, and we want to keep it that way. We know that even physicians need more time with the patients than they're getting, and that's part of the other reason. We need this to be patient-centered care. You cannot take care of someone usually in 15 minutes. And you have to know context, you have to understand the person. And also, I just want to mention that as a nurse practitioner, you know the public doesn't really understand your role. So it's almost like you have to do it twice as good. You really have to bring your whole self there, prove yourself, have some wins, get the bank account up that says, yes, I really was treated well, I did have a good outcome, and the confidence builds. And because physicians can't endorse you often because they don't understand what you do, it has been a double challenge for a nurse practitioner to establish herself. But those who are established are very successful. Hawaii has just about 800 right now, and they're producing about 50 a year, if my estimates are correct. So this is going to be a growing presence, and what I hope people will see that this is part of the solution to access to quality care.
And this is not just a Band-Aid situation for the physician shortage, but really it's a way of reevaluating who is best to give what care,
when,
in what way, and when.
Absolutely. And so I think people thinking that it's an either-or rather than how this expands the spectrum of care is a misnomer. And we want that reframed as a quality opportunity, not a secondary slippery slope Band-Aid.
At this point, where you say we have 50 who are coming out roughly annually, are they able to find jobs here?
Yes, they are. Nurse practitioners are in big demand, and I think as the health insurance exchange is set up and we implement the second phase of Obamacare, 50 to 100,000 people are going to be able for the first time to have access to health care in a more reasonable way, in a more level playing field. And so that need is going to only grow. And we have hospitals hiring nurse practitioners now, as well as the seeking of having more of them in primary care and in
and in rural areas.
Yes.
Well, it looks like everyone's going to get a real education about how great nurse practitioners can be. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Deborah Gardner is a PhD, RN, FN, APN, FAAN. Those last two you may not know are Forum of Nurses in Advanced Practice and Fellow of the American Academy of Nursing. She's the Hawaii State Center for Nursing Executive Director and was the Chief of Planning at the National Institutes of Health. She's also on the editorial board of Nursing Economics and is the lead columnist for the Health Policy column. This week is Nursing Week.
Hi, good morning. I'm Andy from the Kapilina Interactive Arts Society. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
Earlier today, we were looking at the phenomenon of the drive-in eatery. On Oahu, there have been quite a few. KC Drive-In, Chunky's Drive-In, Cow Cow Corner. Just a few names that resonate in the collective memory of island boomers who fondly recall the culture of their youth. Fast cars, fast food, and rock and roll. Scotty's Drive-In on Keomoku opened in 1956, not far from where HPR is now. A year later, a windward spot sported car hops near the edge of Kailua's Coconut Grove. It became an overnight success, reportedly selling 3,600 hamburgers for 17 cents apiece on its opening day. Today, we asked you to name the eatery and its owners, remembered fondly on message boards where some folks still talk about the signature flavors they miss, the tangy red and yellow hamburger sauces that coated the buns of shrimp burgers, mahi burgers, hamburgers, regular, double, or double deluxe. But after 42 years of feeding Kailua families, Andy's Drive-In, started by Andrew Wong and his brother-in-law Ben Lum, closed on Saturday, May 29, 1999. That's today's quiz, and if you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Their influences are all over the map, and that's just the way they like it. More and more bands these days draw their inspiration from all over, to the point where you hear Jimi Hendrix and Johnny Cash cited under a single musical umbrella. It takes an exceptionally big umbrella to contain the North Shore band Jungle Rocket, which is coming to our Atherton Performing Arts Studio this weekend. It's homegrown music, and Larry McElhenney is on hand with his guitar to give us a taste. Larry, how did this music come about?
Oh, man. The music itself influenced all the members over the years. I'm the oldest. I was born in 1945, so my influences go way back to early rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Howe's here next to me. His bluegrass influences, so on. Jimi Hendrix, as you mentioned. Jimbo Walsh, our drummer, has been all over Nashville, Austin, Chicago, so multiple influences there. We got together as friends, you know, just as a hobby, about 3 or 4 years ago, Bill and I initially, and, you know, enjoyed each other's company and enjoyed making music together. And then Jimbo showed up, and the rest is history.
When you form a band out of these different personalities, you don't necessarily know exactly how the music's going to end up, do you?
No, that's really, that's part of the fascination of it, especially with our group, you never know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. We try and keep it as informal and as fun as possible and spontaneous. You know, a lot of times there are some real pleasant artistic accidents that happen. On the other hand, there's a catastrophe now and then, but that's just part of the game.
Well, if you court catastrophe, you also there's the opportunity of having things turn out really great, right?
Yeah, that's our philosophy. we like to play on the edge.
if you're too afraid of catastrophe, I sometimes think you're never going to get anywhere. You know?
Yeah. Well, it's for some reason it seems to be working for us.
Excellent. Well, you were talking about maybe a couple of samples you could play of your music, and the first one you said was kind of bluegrass influence. Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say.
All right, let me hear a little bit of it. You and Bill Howes on lead guitar.
Yeah.
That's what you might call kind of a bluegrass breakdown kind of an instrumental tune,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, but you also veer toward the blues as well. Have you got some vocals with your blues?
Yeah, I like to have Bill do a song. I'm not sure where it originated. It's called Got Your Mojo Working.
Uh-huh.
Muddy Waters, Paul Butterfield,
yeah,
and Jungle Rocket also.
It's credited to Muddy Waters.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Muddy Waters tune. So that's a couple of different extremes of American music, almost the bluegrass and the blues strain. It used to be those didn't mix that much in a single band, but those days have kind of changed, huh, Larry?
Yeah, we we try and draw on, you know, blues, country, whatever.
Yeah.
We like to have a good time. Bill likes to do songs that are funny, you know, so we try and do a couple of humorous songs also. We do a song called Funky Chicken, probably not appropriate here on...
Would that be the Rufus
yeah,
Thomas
Rufus
Funky
Thomas,
Chicken?
Yeah,
that's
Bill,
a classic.
And Bill, Bill does all the chicken noises, too, at the beginning. So.
Great piece of music.
Yeah, it's fun. Yeah.
So you really don't have any boundaries to what you guys will take on, yeah?
Maybe I'll let Bill respond to that.
Well, we try to be as creative as we can, I guess. And we like to look at different influences, you know, funk, jazz, bluegrass, blues, even a little reggae.
Well, it's great to have you guys. Thanks very much for coming on the show. Bill Howells, you just heard, is the guitarist, and Larry McElhaney. McElhaney plays guitar and bass in Jungle Rocket, the North Shore band. It's playing on our Atherton studio this Saturday. You can learn more from our HPR website.
That rhythm, every country and every land, it's good for everybody, in heaven and on this earth. I know it's felt all over the world, even in the universe. So, Abyssinia, my home. Oh, Abyssinia, my home.
Do you really know a lot of people that say she's good-looking? You must have a wide acquaintance among the astigmatic, haven't you, Freddie?
Dorothy Parker's hilarious Just a Little One, this week on Selected Shorts from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 5, following Travel with Rick Steves.
Alex George hails from England, where he published 4 novels. Then he moved to Missouri and began writing about a fictional immigrant family.
First of all, I wanted to write about Missouri because it's where I live, and because I think there's something quintessentially American about the place.
Alex George reads from his debut American novel, A Good American, next time on New Letters on the Air.
This evening at 6:30, right after Marketplace.
A little earlier this half hour, we were talking with Deb Garner about nurse practitioners and APNs and the fact that we really don't have a lot of understanding of what they do or even experience with them. Have you ever seen one?
No, not. And yet, as you asked me that question on the break, and I was thinking, no, but I've probably had a number of things done by physicians that could have been done by a nurse practitioner.
Which is exactly what some docs are saying, that really in reevaluating the delivery of medical services, the who does what and when and how is really where it's going now. When we had Nadine Tensale on the show last Thursday on Town Square, her point is, you know, that's where we're at right now in trying to create a plan, is trying to incorporate some of these other people who have really good skills that we haven't been using. And to hear what we just heard a little while ago, that, you know, they've been around for 40 years, but not very much in Hawaii.
Well, there's been this movement in the medical community toward asking the patients what they want, and you know, sort of a customer service orientation that I'm not sure is all to the good, because what you really want is expertise, and if that has to be imposed on you, so be it.
Well, at some point, people are going to see nurse practitioners, and then they'll be asking for them, because they do spend a great deal of time, and that's a good thing. That's going to do it for us, because time is waning. We're going to see you, though, tomorrow with a follow-up on the mayor's plan for the natatorium from the mayor.
And a taste of Celtic culture very far from home on Maui.
You want to make sure you get the whole show, even if you can't listen in the morning? Well, you can sign up for the podcast on the HPR website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org, or you can download it from the archive.
Talk back to your radio and us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, and tweet us at HI Conversation, or email us at talkback@HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vander.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Meet us back here in the morning for more of The Conversation. Have a good day.